Prennent soin des patients avec cœur et dévouement. Aujourd'hui, c'est à notre tour de prendre soin de ces professionnels en valorisant leurs compétences et en assurant rapidement un meilleur équilibre entre travail et vie familiale. C'est également l'occasion pour les personnes qui ont quitté le réseau public de revenir prêter main forte avec de meilleures conditions. Plus que jamais, nous avons besoin d'elles pour améliorer la vie des patients. Pour en connaître davantage sur notre plan d'action, rendez-vous à québec.ca/infirmière. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
What's up, everyone? This is DJ Killajoule, Montreal, born and raised, and I've been rocking the deck since 97. I've played with everyone from DJ Kubert to Mixmaster Mike, and I'll be the DJ once again for the second season of La Fin des Faibles on Télé-Québec. I'm here to announce the release of my upcoming EP, Sagittarius, which launches Friday, October 22nd at Ausgang Plaza. Doors open at 7 p.m. LTs will kick things off, followed by performances by End of the Week, Sunday Scratch Sessions, and the legendary B-Girl crew. Live visuals provided by Mourad Benacer. Space is limited, so get your tickets online now at pointdevente.com. The show is a CKUT co-presentation and sponsored by Prohibition.
Are you ready?
Are you ready for the sound experience of a lifetime? Are you ready for crystal clarity in sonic bliss? Are you ready for CKUT? We're ready for you. 90.3 on your FM dial.
Scheduled conversation extravaganza from the radio studio of CKUT 90.3 Montreal. The sometimes glib, often spontaneous exploration and discussion of ideas esoteric and artistic. I congratulate myself as your host, Bruce Gottlieb, who is very excited to welcome the musician Fred Frith.
Does he sound excited to you? He's reading this off a bit of paper, you know.
Yes, I composed it this morning. It's freshly composed. To this wooden chair in particular, in Montreal in general. Welcome, Fred.
Hello.
Hello. That's how he answers the phone, too, by the way. Just to give me in particular and the listening audience in general an idea, how much that song bears your name on the record?
That's because I wrote it. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I know what you mean. But how much of it did you write, actually? This is on an album by.
Are you accusing me of stealing other people's material?
No. I'm just wondering, like, of all of what the instruments are doing.
Oh, I see. Obviously, Chris is a law unto himself, the drummer.
Mm-hmm. Chris Cutler.
So I didn't write any drum parts. Other than that, I would think about 85%. There's a couple of solos.
The clarinet theme.
There's a bassoon solo.
Mm-hmm.
There's some kind of a soprano solo. That's it. Everything else is scored.
All right. And that's more or less the same thing that happened over the whole album. That kind of...
It varied from song to song. Actually, that particular record, I would say, leans pretty heavily towards compositional structure.
Mm-hmm.
There's not all that much improvising on the record. That song maybe has more improvising than some of the others do.
The improvisation was before, generally, or was...
Before what?
Before before you settled everything down in the structure that you...
It varied mostly after.
Mostly after.
Yeah, I mean, mostly they were pieces that either Mark or I knew what they were going to be, and we...
Mark Hollander,
right. Excuse me. And rehearsed them with the group as it was, and then recorded the compositional side of it, and then the solos were added afterwards, although sometimes they were done at the same time as the rhythm section.
Okay, so it wasn't all done live, then?
No, that was all studio
all
recording.
Yeah. One instrument at a time.
No. I mean, it was a studio recording, and which we played them together, you know, like a group, you know what I'm saying?
That's right. Well, the album we're talking about is the Un peu de l'âme des bandits, Aksak Maboul's first album, second album.
Yeah,
yeah. Mark Hollander did the first one more or less alone.
I think there's going to be a third one, too, but it's basically Mark Hollander's project.
Right.
Mark is a Belgian Israeli who lives in Brussels and invites people to do projects with him, and that was one of them.
Mm.
And so the people who played on that particular manifestation of the group didn't really play together again as a group after about a month after the record was made.
All right, you went on to Skeleton Crew after that, or was
a long time after.
Long time after. What was Slap Happy after that then?
Oh, no, that was a long time before.
That was a long time before. Oh, well, I've gotten confused.
Maybe I'm lying, too.
Maybe you are.
This is something you always have to bear in mind. Like, because I was actually not lying, but sometimes something seems like a long time, but when I actually think of the chronology, it's not that long.
Mm.
For example, Skeleton Crew began in 83, and that record was good in 80, and that's not such a long time.
Mm.
But the amount of stuff that happened between 80 and 83 was such a lot that I kind of tend to think of it as being 10 years.
Well, for instance, what was going on between...
Actually, it was before 80, anyway. It was 79.
Mm-hmm.
Because after that record and before Skeleton Crew, I recorded all three of the records for Ralph, for example, Gravity Speechless and Cheap at Half the Price, and did Massacre, and did a whole bunch of improvised gigs with various people.
Henry Kaiser.
And did at least one of the Henry Kaiser records. In fact, both of the Henry Kaiser records were before Skeleton Crew. So
on the Metam...
On the Metalanguage.
Metalanguage.
Yeah. So that's a lot of work in between those projects.
Yeah, a lot of improvisational stuff too, I guess. Or
yeah, about 50-50.
The latest album, the Technology of Tears, sounds... It's all your own project, right?
No.
I didn't see many other instruments on it.
Oh, I see. From that point of view, mostly yes. No, I thought you were talking about the project itself, because the work on Technology of Tears is actually commissioned work.
For dance
and theatre pieces. Mm. Two dance pieces and one theatre piece. And it would be unfair to think of it as my project only as much as, for example, on both of the dance pieces, I collaborated fairly intensively with the choreographer who was involved in the editing and everything about the musical structure of the piece. So it was a pretty close collaboration. And also, actually, we were working with a filmmaker from Montreal, Pierre Hébert, who you may have heard of.
Yes, Jérôme and Lucie were working.
Yes, they worked with him too, and he did the animation for the dance performances in New York. So it was also we were also working with him.
So there was a homogeneity of
of ideas there, then.
Well, the basic idea for Technology of Tears came from Rose Newman, the choreographer. Mm-hmm. I had to translate it into musical terms, and also, since it was the first time I'd really collaborated with a non-musician, it took a little while to learn how to understand each other. Mm. I mean, there are a lot of interesting things about working with dancers. For one thing, they feel time much more sensitively than musicians do, which was a shock to me, because they have to move to it, so they feel every nuance of tempo. If I copied a cassette on a machine that was running slightly too fast or too slow, the dancers would immediately know that there was something wrong with it, even though in pitch-wise, the difference was very, very slight, not even half a quarter tone.
Mm.
But in terms of moving to it, your body tells you right away when something's going wrong.
Yeah, well, it's a lot more exertion than in your ears. Eh?
I guess. Well, you don't know what's going on in there, do you?
Yeah, it's interesting. This album, as well as in the later Skeleton Crew album, the Learn to Talk album, you're experimenting a lot more with the taped voice and other recorded sound, sampled voice, is it true? Instead of having live singing or
I'm raising my eyebrows up
singer.
And down.
Yes, he's raising his eyebrows up. Disconcertingly, I might add.
What are you talking about now? Hmm?
Well, the later albums, you've been using a lot more taped voice material and other editing techniques such as that. Seems moving away from a kind of live sounding.
It depends how late is late. I mean, over the course of my recording life, the amount of experimentation with things like that has varied a lot. I mean, I could point, for example, at something like In Praise of Learning by Henry Cow and say that there was an awful lot of use of experimental techniques in the studio with tapes and so on. And then I could point at Speechless, where in particular there was a great deal of tape editing. And use of treated voice also, so it's not that new. It just if you look at my work over a period of time, you start to understand the various kind of little obsessions that motivate me, and they kind of ebb and flow within the body of what I'm doing. So sometimes you don't hear one thing so much, and then later on it'll emerge again, you know, in some new form. And I'm I'm working a lot with the sampling now, yes, but not quite in the way that you might understand it. Also, I hate to talk about sampling, because it kind of always implies a certain facile way of using technology, whereas most forms of technology that become fashionable have come from somewhere else. And I always like to say that something like sampling, for example, was being used in the studio long before the word sampling was thought of. Just in the way that Frippertronics, for example, was being used in studios long before it had a name, Frippertronics, which is what Fripp decided to call it.
Right.
It was a standard studio technique for achieving echo. And sampling, I mean, the Outbez records use a lot of techniques which could be thought of as sampling. I mean, we, for example, using noise gates, we used to trigger things like vacuum cleaners to make snare drums sound different and stuff like that, which is all similar use of found sound to what the samplers do a little bit quicker now.
Yeah, with the word aspect, the literature aspect of the music in that way, and also in a way before that seemed to de-emphasize the singing aspect of the voice, that you were shouting and howling and having other non-singers.
That's because I'm completely incapable of doing anything else.
Mm. But of course there are singers around. And they are unsatisfactory.
Not at all. I love singers. Mm. I like working with singers. It's more a question of stretching myself rather than rejecting somebody else's skill. I mean, I still like to work with singers when possible.
Mm.
But I also wanted to use my voice again. It really, as a result of what happened in 77 when the punk movement started in England, and a lot of so-called non-musicians, although I don't like the distinction myself, I think, to digress, there's a tendency to think, when people talk about non-musicians being able to do things that musicians couldn't do, I think a lot of musicians can do the same kinds of things that non-musicians do. It's just that they don't, there's too much of a distinction between the two fields. Mm-hmm. Anyway, without going too far in that direction, when punk arrived, a lot of people started to sing and use their voices who would not normally have been considered singers.
and who I really liked a lot. I mean, of course, John Lydon, but also I was a big fan of polystyrene from X-Ray Specs. And
it was an aesthetic, oral aesthetic.
Yeah, I liked it a lot. I just liked the idea of being able to get up and shout and not be criticized for not being able to sing. I mean, and a friend of mine, Christoph Anders from Casiba, when I first heard Casiba play, he really inspired me to start doing it myself, partly by actually encouraging me and partly because I realized that if he could do it, I could do it. And so I started with Skeleton Crew, obviously unable to sing, but nevertheless using a voice and words in whatever way I could.
And they're more tied together, I guess, in that way, because you're doing both at the same time, the music and the words.
Well, one of the experiences we had with Skeleton Crew, which was interesting, with singing and playing and doing all the instruments at the same time, there were two levels to it. One was that we discovered, for example, that when you're playing several instruments at the same time, you've got a bass drum and a snare drum and a guitar and you're singing and you're trying to do all of that in some kind of semblance of order. One thing that it does for the music is that it completely changes the kind of rhythmic emphasis that the music has, and you find the rhythms that are being made are not the kind of rhythms that you could make if you were working with a drummer. It comes out completely differently.
Why is the economist taking?
Conscience.
Well, governments are running up to two generations that have to pay.
Tuberculosis.
Generations cannot be.
Tools.
You can see all the silly things.
Tumor.
With their money.
Tourists.
They'll have to pay back.
Turnable.
Eyes observation.
Tundra.
Good evening.
How you were going to fade that. If you'd been really tight, you see, you could have just stopped it dead right there. But no, he blew it.
Yes. Well, so that was the Skeleton Crew from the Learn to Talk album.
How topical, yes.
How topical, just what we were talking about. The... Speaking about topical, the Skeleton Crew album, especially that one in particular.
Yes.
Skeleton Crew albums in general, that being.
Yeah.
Have a decidedly political, or some more political cast to them than most of the other music that you're involved in.
Disagree.
You disagree?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what else was political? Then?
Well, Henry Cow was kind of notorious for being political throughout our life. Often when we were not being so, we were being castigated for our politics in the music press, for example.
Mm.
And I would say that you couldn't really say that the Outbears records were not... anything that I've done with words has tended to have some kind of political content, because that's when you start to hear the political content. I mean, there are two aspects to this. First of all, in one sense, everything that I do has a political content, in as much as I choose to work in a certain way and in a certain context, and obviously outside of the mainstream of the music business, and that's a conscious decision on my part, and therefore that involves some form of politics. And secondly, if you use lyrics, then they start to express a content which can be verbalized, and that's usually got some kind of political dimension.
Now, what you were saying about not being able to play the same rhythms and such, that was unfortunately dissolved just before that tune. What for instance, in that last tune, what was new, or would you say that these things were created by the situation of having to play, let's say, guitar, drums?
Yeah. Well, what I hear when I hear that song that we just heard, for example, is that the relationship between the guitar and the bass is very dissimilar to the kinds of relationships that guitars and bass have in conventional music where you have a drummer, because they have a tension which entirely is the result of the fact that several of the holes in the bass part are taken up by one of one's limbs hitting something. And so the whole part is broken up in a different way. In a way, it's the same as if you were playing a whole drum kit, except that I didn't think it was that.
Well, people are very enthusiastic.
This is a very strange station. it's as if you're playing a drum kit, and instead of with your right hand hitting one drum and with your left foot hitting a hi-hat, those two things are taken up with playing an instrument.
Right.
And so, in a sense, you start to take up the rhythmic aspects of the instruments other than the drums in a more particular way. And in the same token, by the same token, when you play the drums, it's so much sparser that they start to sound, have a more melodic element. And so the roles of the two instruments are kind of mixed up. Added to which, of course, the fact is that one person playing two or three instruments at once is hard enough, and when you have two people trying to do it at the same time with each other and play in time with each other, it's almost impossible, and it results in a kind of tension which is aptly described by somebody who saw one of our concerts as sounding like a ship very slowly sinking, which always somehow just manages to make it to port before going under. So nobody ever gets drowned, but you always feel as if they're about to any minute.
The wobbly deck.
Which, that's certainly how it felt with Skeleton Crew when we used to play on stage a lot of the time.
When you came to Montreal 4 years ago, I think, it was with Zena Parkins and Tom Cora.
Yeah, well, after Zena joined, in a way, I think one of the reasons we stopped playing was because we got too good at it, the technique. Mm-hmm. I mean, with Zena playing as well, and we were playing a lot of concerts, so we had ample chance to practice. My feeling in the end was that the songs were starting to become more and more slick, and in a way, therefore, less interesting. Because a lot of what I liked about Skeleton Crew was the tension involved in the process of performing in that way. And as soon as it became a formula that we were just reproducing, there was somehow no tension left in the music anymore. And that's why we stopped rather than go on. Because we had lots of demand to perform and still do, but somehow there's no point in doing it unless there's some kind of an edge to it. So maybe we were talking about getting back together with a drummer and doing something completely different. And that might happen as well.
That wasn't the interest anymore. So.
Right.
Well, so what happened after Skeleton Crew? Did dissolve? That was...
Well,
70s,
after 80s. Skeleton Crew, it's about 2 years ago, but we finally stopped playing, I guess, 86 we stopped playing. Since then, I mean, Tom and Zena and I have always been busy on other things, and Tom has become very busy. He's playing in Curlew, he's playing in a group called Nemal, who'll be at Victoriaville this year. He's doing a lot of solo projects. Zena is also in a couple of bands. No Safety is one, which is a very interesting group from New York. And she does solo projects. So they've got a whole bunch of things that they're doing. And I've been actually concentrating more on commissional kind of work. First off, I had the dance commissions, then I had the theatre commission, which are now all on Technology of Tears. And I enjoyed that and learned a lot from it, so it's kind of impelled me in certain other directions.
These are American commissions.
Huh? Yeah, one Boston dance company and a New York dance company and a New York theatre group.
And at present you're working, this morning you were working on a soundtrack for a film.
And this afternoon. The work never stops. Yeah, I'm doing, that's been going on for 2 years actually in gestation. But we finally started the recording process about 2 weeks ago at the NFB, mm-hmm. ONF, depending on your point of view. And it's very hard to do that kind of creative work in a bureaucracy. This is a very strange place. People keep cheering.
It's your fan club, I think.
Well, there's just one person in a room with a tape recorder who keeps waving their hands. Strange.
Mm. I'd just like to make you feel at home.
It's not like this at home, I promise. The thing about working at the NFB is you go into a studio at 9 o'clock in the morning and you come out at 5 o'clock in the evening, just like any other bureaucrat.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of, I'm finding it a little hard to adjust to the schedule, but...
You even have to commute. It's right on the edge of Montreal.
Exactly, right? Yes. We have to drive there and drive back. But it's very good, very interesting. We'll hear a bit of what I've been doing if you want later on.
Oh, yes, that's right. We have a cassette of that. okay, well, what I could ask you about first is something that occurred to me.
All right.
How about something that occurred to me? The Curlew album that has just been put out.
Yeah.
It seems to me a fairly mathematical kind of dry album. I don't know if you
haven't heard it.
You haven't heard it. Anyway, it reminds me a little bit of I don't remember what it reminds me of, but it seems to me that your violin style and especially in your violin style and guitar style seems to at one point moved away from a intellectual kind of aspect towards a new kind of naturalness, like from folk song aesthetic and associated other sources of...
I'm very wary of trying to split music up into categories of intellectuality and non-intellectuality. I find, for example, that especially media people, notably written word journalists, tend to be very afraid of their own intellectuality when talking about music. And they always seem to want to deny... that they're intellectuals in order to somehow justify themselves as writers. And so they put down anything that they vaguely consider intellectual in music, which I think is very stupid. Music of all kinds can have some kind of an intellectual content, and it's not something that necessarily has to be bad. It doesn't necessarily have to be good either, but it's just something that's there in the music, and it's a mistake to judge the music on that part of its content, I think. It's just another part of what the music is. Now, it's true to say that after Henry Cow, when I'd been kind of inclined to regard myself as a serious composer and kind of fall flat on my face, because I don't think that's really what I am in the sense that I thought I was then. When Henry Cow broke up, I reacted very strongly against the image of myself that I'd built up. And I was particularly interested in going back to some of the things that I'd done before Henry Cow and rediscovering my own roots, my own musical roots. And one of the things that I'd done before Henry Cow a lot was to play in folk clubs in England, playing traditional music and also improvising, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And Henry Cow's demise gave me the opportunity to explore some other aspects of music that I liked. And the Art Bears and Gravity in particular were all were projects which came out of a very different take on music to the take that I'd had in Henry Cow. And it's true that I use a lot of folklore, and I still use a lot of folkloric aspects. But I don't think of that as being anti-intellectual, necessarily. And I also think that it's interesting how very often... In fact, this might be a good opportunity to play the cassette, because we were talking about it today with the director. But very often when you're writing music on the page, you experiment with mathematical things, because music can be broken down into math very easily,
yeah.
Rhythmically or pitch-wise, or serially, in other words. And it's always surprised me how sometimes the driest exercises, which you just put on a piece of paper without even really thinking about it, can turn into the most beautiful and strange music, which sounds completely natural and felt.
Mm.
It really depends on what happens when you put the basic thing down first and then how it's interpreted afterwards. I mean, the most joyous and beautiful music can be played in a dry, academic way and sound like nothing.
Mm-hmm.
I remember one of the most disappointing things about Cornelius Cardew when he went into his political period in England was that he played very famous old workers' songs, but in a group who were totally unaccustomed to playing that stuff with any real sense of what it was that they were playing. They played it like academic musicians playing avant-garde music, which is where the background that they'd come from, and they made that music sound completely stupid to my ears. And yet sometimes you can hear something which has obviously been generated serially and mathematically and without even necessarily having very much input at the beginning from the composer other than numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And it can turn into something quite remarkably moving. And the reason I said it might be interesting to go to this today was that I was working on a series of cycles, in fact, with a drum machine, working with a little drum machine, a fairly cheap one. And when we finally finished the song based on these cycles, it sounds like the kind of drummer who's really loose. It doesn't at all sound like a mathematical drum machine. It sounds like somebody who's always kind of crazily off the beat, and yet it's all generated in its inception as a mathematical series. So you should see what you think about that.
Proud to announce the opening of its new bar gallery with cool room and ambient music. The new bar is adjacent to the discotheque and is located at 87 St. Catherine East. It's new, it's different, and it's open now.
Oh, good.
Well, hello. In case you're just joining us, I'm here in the CKUT 90.3 Montreal studios with Fred Frith, musician, multi-instrumentalist, and performing at Fofun without much further ado.
On Saturday.
Saturday.
Yeah.
So, what we just heard was from the soundtrack you're working on at the NFB.
That's
presently.
How I spent my day today. Yeah, that's today's work you just listened to.
Yeah.
It's a feature film called The Top of His Head, directed by Peter Mettler.
He's a Torontonian.
And I'm doing the whole soundtrack. It's comprised of a lot of different kinds of things. And obviously what you just heard, since it was only recorded today, hasn't even been finished, let alone mixed. So what you heard was pretty rough. But it's kind of one aspect of the kind of soundtrack you can expect to hear.
And what does this particular excerpt pertain to in the film?
In the film, the protagonist, who is a satellite dish salesman, is actually, it's far too complicated to even explain remotely what is happening. This guy is being pursued by people he doesn't understand why, and he doesn't know who they are, and he's eventually hounded. He's in the countryside, he's miles from anywhere, and he has some strange dreams and experiences, and he's just stolen a car, and he's driving the car round and round in circles. And he's switched on the car radio, and this is one of the things that he hears on the car radio.
Mm. Fortuitously.
Now you know.
And he was tuned right into the soundtrack.
Right, and he probably tuned to this station. In fact, he's probably still out there.
Yeah, he's awaiting the end of the film, I guess.
It could be a while.
So you laid all the instrumental tracks on yourself for this soundtrack, or for that particular piece?
For that piece, yes, but I mean, some of it is done with my trusty computer, and some of it with a drum machine, and some of it with me playing real instruments the way they used to. And tomorrow Jean Derome will come and play some saxophone on it.
Mm-hmm. On that piece?
Yeah.
So it's not finished at all?
No.
So the computer was doing this synthesizer sequence and drum sequence?
The computer was driving the drums, which were obviously programmed by me, but yeah. Basically, the computer was the sequence was pushing three different synthesizers, well, two samplers, a synthesizer, and a drum machine.
So you had two time frames you were working with in that piece. Then it seemed that there was the guitar area, and the drum.
It's all the same.
Yeah.
It's just that the drum pattern. This is what I was talking about before. The way that the drum is programmed, which was in its inception mathematical, ends up sounding as if it's in a really weird time relation to everything else, although in fact it's exactly the same. It's just played in a strange relation to the beat.
It sounds somewhat along the same tact as the Technology of Tears album.
That's not surprising, because I also did that.
Yeah, I guess so. Also, it's just recent too, I guess. But are there voices in this soundtrack as well?
Yeah, there's various little bits and pieces of voice. Well, the main female actor in the piece is doing a little bit of singing, and also Jane Siberry is doing a little bit of singing in it.
Mm.
And there'll be also cello, John Derome's saxophone, maybe a bass trombone, this and that, still planned.
Were you the inspiration for the Les Granules, the two one-man band outfit that Dave Holm and Lucier are?
You better ask them about that.
You know.
No, I don't.
No?
I mean, I don't know whether we were the inspiration for that. No, I mean, anyway, it's hardly relevant, you know, because it's obviously Jean and Rene are their own force in life, and they've been a very creative part of Montreal music scene for years and years. So.
Mm-hmm.
Not as if they're looking for inspiration particularly at this point.
What you said earlier was that you'd made a conscious decision not to join the commercial music area. I've kind of felt of late is that it is a natural situation that the non-commercial music the unrecognized music scene, whatever the alternative, whatever independent, generally, of course, doesn't get the attention it should, because it's too novel or it's just not to the mean palate. But nevertheless, ends up being what happens is commercial music ends up borrowing from all the experiments that the independent music scene does, and
that works both ways.
Feeds off it.
That works both ways. I mean, I know one of the most fashionable people for supposedly avant-garde experimental rock musicians to listen to at the moment is Prince, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And especially Prince's production techniques are of great interest to a lot of alternative musicians because they're very interesting. So it's not as if the forefront of commercial music is necessarily low on ideas. And it's not necessarily either as if they're always in the position of leeching off the alternative. It's not nothing is ever as clearly black and white as that. It happens both ways. And obviously, yes, there's a kind of a division system in the way that commercial music works, whereby one is considered to be in the second division until one's signed by a major label, when one suddenly becomes first division, if I may use sporting metaphors here, which journalists usually do. All of that kind of stuff is kind of silly to me. In any case, I'm well aware that what I do is not going to be commercial in that sense, and I don't have any great illusions that if suddenly I was getting lots and lots of airplay, people would rush out and buy my records, because I don't think that would happen either. And in some cases, some of my records would undoubtedly have sold a lot more if it had more exposure, but in other cases, like Live in Japan or something, there's no way that that's going to be a popular record by any stretch of the imagination, and if I was said otherwise, I'd be kidding myself. What this is really about, as far as I'm concerned, is to try and have as realistic a relationship as possible with one's audience, to kind of know who my audience is, to work in a more community-oriented sense than in some sense where you don't really know anything about what's going on in your life, which is what tends to happen with commercial music, where managers and agents are more or less dictating your movements, and you're put into hotels and taken from place to place, and you're very insulated from the kind of environments that you play in. And I prefer to work with a network which musicians themselves have helped to create, and where you know the promoters that you're going to be playing for because they're part of a kind of extended family of people who exist all over the world, and you know, you feel like you're much more a part of some kind of vital exchange. And in that sense, I would rather be that and selling less records than, you know, much better off and selling a lot of records but feeling completely isolated from any contact with any real goings on.
Yeah, so the community you're talking about is musicians and a select audience, some group.
Well, you say
that
select,
you
well, I mean, they sound like an elite, which is what I would advise.
Well, no, it not that
we
it
personally
would be
pick them. If they're not the right people, they can't come and listen to our music.
No, but they are the there are a certain kind of audience you have in mind, or is it a certain kind of mind you have in mind?
I don't have anything in mind. People who come are the people who come. It's just, you know, and I don't. Well, new people are always coming. I didn't wish to imply that there was some kind of, it was shut off from any kind of change. I'm talking more about the working situation, about the people who ask me to play somewhere, or the kinds of places where I stay, or the kinds of other musicians that I work with. As far as the audience concerned, you know, the more people that come, the merrier, and I don't know who they are.
When you went to Japan to do that album, that you got fairly into...
Which album? Oh, Live in Japan.
Live in Japan.
Yeah.
Was that when you went when you produced also the other compilation of
no,
the Japanese music?
That was later. That came about 3 years later.
And you got fairly involved over there in and were instrumental in bringing many Japanese groups to exposure here in the West, such as After Dinner and Katra Durana, Wahaha, and that kind of thing.
Well, yes and no. I mean, there are plenty of other people who were also helping to promote them. I think Welcome to Dreamland certainly helped. But then there are people, you know, who would say that Welcome to Dreamland was very unrepresentative of what's going on in Japanese music now, and I'd say, yeah, you're probably right. But it was just a personal selection of things that I was interested in, which is why I put a little disclaimer on the cover saying, you know, this is not the state of music in Japan today or anything like that.
Yeah.
Because Japan has got an awful lot of different kinds of things happening. And it would be arrogant of me to think that I could encapsulate it on one record.
How long did you spend there doing the research for the record?
Well, I go there every year. And since the first tour, I've toured there, you know, fairly regularly. And so I met people who I got interested in, and over the 3 years before I did it, I'd kind of more or less accumulated a list of the names of the people that I wanted to work with. And so it wasn't specific research that I had to go and do. It was more like, in the end, it was just going over and working with the people that I'd met already. And I was there for only a very short time because I had a tiny budget. I mean, the whole record, including travel and studio costs and everything else, was a $6,000 budget.
Really? All the tunes were recorded specially for that album? Those tunes?
Yeah. I mean, I was in the studio, and every day a new group would come in and record something, and then when they'd all come in, I then mixed it all.
You've worked most extensively with Tenko, Ueno.
Yes, just Tenko.
Just Tenko.
Yes.
She doesn't use Ueno anymore?
Doesn't use the last name, never did.
Oh, all right. Do you know what's happening with Hackle and the and people from After Dinner?
They are about to do a tour of Japan starting this fall, which is good for them because actually they're better known in Europe than they are in Japan. They're very unknown in Japan, actually. Mm. They don't live in Tokyo, which doesn't help. They come from the countryside around Osaka. And they'll be doing a tour with Ferdinand Richard and Bruno Meillet, who have a group called Brunifer, and the two of them are touring together in Japan in October. Tenko was here in the spring for,
right,
for the festival.
For the new...
Femme Innovatrice.
I didn't like the show, but I'm sorry. I wonder...
Which show did you see, the first night?
The Honeymoons, the first night.
First night, okay. I thought it was a great show.
Yeah, actually, it was... Well, there you go. I don't know. I wanted to hear her do something else anyway. But
maybe you will one day.
Maybe you will. I don't know. I mean,
I'll pass her message
kind of,
along.
Okay, good, yeah. So she's smug and wry. you have worked, though, fairly extensively with Tenko Ueno since you first met her. Is there anything in particular you like about her voice or her work? Or
Sure. I think she's an absolutely riveting performer. I think her voice is... it comes from a very deep place in the human psyche for me.
Mm.
When I hear her perform, it makes my hair stand on end. You really want to know these things?
Yes.
No, I think she's a very, very exciting singer. And the thing I like about it, in a way, is the fact that she's not... and nor is she trying to be an experimental avant-garde vocalist. And so many people who are doing voice work, like experimenting with their voice and fooling around with the timbres of the voice, kind of lose their grounding somehow. That you hear a lot of effects and vocal, and it's very technically stunning to hear, but somehow you lose the ground from under the feet of the people who are singing. I remember... at the Victoriaville Festival, when we played with Dent's band, a friend of mine commented on seeing David Moss and Tenko singing side by side. I don't know whether you're familiar with David Moss's work, but he's a very big guy who has a kind of an avant-garde voice where he's always fooling around with his voice timbre, and it's a typical case.
Oh, you have a record out on Rift, do you?
No, it's on a German label. I produced a record for Dent's band. But when Tenko and David Moss sang side by side, this German friend of mine said that it looked like Mickey Mouse singing next to the Buddha, which I thought was very good, with David Moss as Mickey Mouse and Tenko as Buddha, because somehow she was completely like a tree. She was completely coming out of the ground with her voice, and it's very powerful, this sensation. Whereas all this kind of more experimental kind of vocalizing sometimes just gets a bit, you know, so what?
It's separate from the music at hand.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the Jigsaw Coda?
Yeah, that was actually that was the original ending of Jigsaw, but the choreographer said it was too cheerful.
Oh, yeah.
So we took the tune out, but I liked it, so we put it on the record as well.
What was the choreography about?
Oh, that's a difficult question. Oh. It was because it's a long piece; it's 40 minutes long. It's pretty for modern dance. It was quite emotional. Modern dance is usually rather cool in the emotional sense, but it was kind of angst laden in a certain way.
Mm.
And the ending, it seemed kind of a bit upbeat for where we'd arrived in that particular moment of the dance.
Mm. So you played it while the crowd was on the way out of the theater?
Well, I didn't play anything. Oh. It was all on tapes.
I mean, it was played.
No,
it wasn't played.
It wasn't
at all.
Played at all in the dance performance. It just ended up on the record.
Hmm. That's it doesn't sound altogether upbeat, though. To me, anyway.
Well, you know, it's just a matter of opinion, really.
Yes, I guess so. Anyway, next. So what we're gonna. I guess what we'll say finally is we'll just talk about the show coming up on Saturday.
Yes.
Which I understand you're going to be playing alone.
Yes.
Yes, with guitar.
Yes.
Cello? No.
Cello? I don't play the cello.
Or violin.
I've never played a cello in my life, thank God. I'm just playing guitars.
Just guitars.
I might sing, but that might put people off. No, I'm not going to sing, I promise. How's that?
You might sing, and you don't know what you're going to play yet, or from... What of your archival?
I will be performing an improvised show, but I would like to say that it's not the guitar on the table approach kind of thing. This is more back to straight guitar playing in a way. In a way. In a way.
Straight guitar playing.
I mean, straighter than the other kind, anyway.
Mm. You mean guitar playing? Is it? Are you getting from the heart feeling? Is that? Are you standing up?
Sometimes I stand up.
Hmm.
Sometimes there are tunes.
There are tunes.
Sometimes the word lyrical springs to mind.
Your mind.
For example,
yes.
What there is left of it after today. But.
And.
And.
And after the word lyrical springs to mind, then the show is over. The lights come up. The beer is finished.
Well, then it's then the ball's in your court after that.
Well, for me to say so. Anyway, so then as it is approaching 10 o'clock and a convenient time for us to finish this little discussion, I'll thank you, Fred Frith.
Thank you.
And my name was Bruce, and you can listen to my show if you aren't tired of my voice already on Wednesday at midnight, at which time I'll play some Fred Frith. As well as many other things.
I thought they wanted you to stop doing that.
Yeah, well, that's his idea. Anyway, Fred is going to be playing on the 20th, which is Saturday.
Saturday,
at 9
o'clock.
It's 8. Can I say that? How much it costs? Yeah, $8 at the door, and $8 if you buy it in advance.
And $28 if you've got no brain.
If you've got no brain, you can give as much money as you want.
Right.
Okay, and this last cut is from also from the Aksak Mabul album. It's called A Modern Lesson. Thank you again.
Thank you. See you Saturday. I'm
Are you a tenant in Montreal? Do you have questions about your rights? Your local housing committee can help. To find the housing committee for your neighborhood or for more resources, go to www.rclalq.qc.ca.